Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's an old line, but a good one. You can't fire me, I quit. In this economy, that's actually a good thing. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 10th of June, and it is good, as always, to have you here. And here is one of those economic reports that make you want to stop reading economic reports. We are deep in what's been called a jobless recovery. And the Labor Department says that in the past 3 months, more people have quit their jobs than been laid off. Nobody ever said labor economics was an easy thing to figure out, but that one does seem to fly in the face of common sense. Until you hear what Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has to say.
More than 8 million people lost their jobs in 2008 and 2009, and almost nobody was quitting. Until now, Gary Chason studies labor issues at Clark University.
It means that workers feel confident in the economy. I think that people are less frightened. I think that people now feel as if the jobs they wanted are starting to open up.
27-year-old Katie Sharland just quit her job. She graduated from a master's program last year, hoping to work in the nonprofit sector.
It was pretty rough. I remember that whole summer I looked for jobs endlessly in every field I could think of, and I got pretty creative.
Creative enough that she took a job in publishing. She kept looking, though, and a few weeks ago, she landed the job she wanted.
I think I'm on the front lines of the economy getting better and people starting to take a positive outlook.
In a labor market that has had more than its share of dark clouds, it's a little bit of sunshine.
That's labor economist Harley Shaken. He says more people quitting does show increased confidence in the economy. But whether there's reason to be confident is unclear.
There is some cause for optimism when one looks at the overall economy, but the labor market remains pretty grim.
Shaken points out that for every open job, there are 5 people looking, and job growth has consistently come in below expectations. Clark University's Gary Chason points out quitting could also mean jobs have gotten harder as employers trim staff and load more work onto the survivors. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Oil continues to leak into the Gulf of Mexico. Politicians continue to be angry, and investors mostly continue to dump BP stock. Shares did bounce back today amid a tidy rally on Wall Street, but people are starting to pay a lot of attention to BP shareholders, specifically the dividend they're scheduled to get in a couple of months. Given how much BP stock has dropped in value since the oil spill began, it's basically lost half of what it was worth. That dividend is one of the only attractive things left about being a BP shareholder, unless Washington has anything to say about it. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
When BP's shares started falling uncontrollably yesterday, the company said it was unaware of any reason for the stock drop. That may have been a clever way of signaling to worried investors that the dividend was still on the table. Analyst Alex Morris covers BP for Raymond James.
BP is in a position to give a dividend. They can if they want to. It all comes down to how big this public pressure coming out of Washington gets and whether they're going to bow to that.
That pressure increased again today. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked if BP should withhold its dividend until it has paid claims from Gulf Coast victims.
Of course. And that would be their best public relations.
The mayor of London has responded to Washington's anger with a reminder. Many of the shareholders who'd be affected by a dividend cut are British retirees, some of whom rely on the dividend for income. And 39% of BP shareholders are right here in the U.S. That includes public funds in California and Texas. Fadel Gate is managing director of oil and gas research with Oppenheimer & Company.
If they suspend the dividend, there are certain pension fund and some income fund that under their charter cannot hold the stock, and they have to get rid of it.
Something that would drive BP's stock price down even further. British Prime Minister David Cameron will discuss BP with President Obama by phone this weekend. He may have to channel the concerns of more than a few annoyed constituents thousands of miles from the oil spill. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Google and Apple are at it again, and not in a warm and cuddly way. Technology's big two are arguing over apps and ads. Google's annoyed about some rule changes announced this week for application developers, rules that could keep Google and other Apple rivals from placing ads inside the applications being built for iPhones and iPads. The beautiful part here? Apple is gearing up to launch its own advertising system, don't you know, called iAd this summer. From North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
This latest spat is about all that valuable data that mobile ad companies collect about us. You know, where we go, what we buy, what apps we use. Analyst Ben Schachter at Broadpoint Amtech says Apple doesn't want to share that critical information with competitors like Google.
Their argument would be to say, you're not entitled to have that data. You know, we don't get data that Google collects on users that go to the Google sites.
But Apple's changes are costly for people like Rob Terrell. His company, TouchCentric, makes apps for the iPhone and iPad and for Google's Android smartphone.
It feels like mom and dad are fighting, and I want to put my hands over my ears and wait for it to stop.
If only it were that easy. TouchCentric was set to release a free iPad app this week. The app would have contained ads placed by Google through its advertising arm, AdMob. The ads would have paid for the cost of developing the app.
Now we can't do that. And unfortunately, Apple doesn't offer the iAd system for iPad applications yet. So we're kind of stuck.
Apple's iAd advertising system is set to debut this July. Standard & Poor's analyst Scott Kessler says controlling mobile data gives Apple a huge advantage on the Internet.
They have, over the last number of months, done a number of things to raise some eyebrows.
Kessler says federal regulators will likely review Apple's new rules for anti-competitiveness. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
All three major indices had BAFO days today. I could give you a reason, I suppose, but really, one never knows why. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's musical chairs right now in big-time college sports. There are rumors the University of Nebraska is leaving the Big 12 Conference, home to schools like Texas and Oklahoma. Nebraska is said to be headed to the Big 10, which includes Michigan and Ohio State. Meanwhile, the Pac-10 is now the Pac-11. Colorado, formerly of the Big 12, is joining USC, Washington, Cal, and Arizona. And the odds are really good that there will be more defections and realignments in the next couple of days. So we're going to step back, take a time out, and try to understand. John Orand of the Sports Business Journal is here to do that. John, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
So the who's doing what to whom of this whole thing just makes my brain hurt. So I'm going to go with a fairly, what I hope is a simple first question. Why is all this happening?
Well, it's happening because all of the schools see a massive payout from in terms of media dollars from other conferences. So the Big 12 right now, their media deal that they have with Fox Sports Net and with ESPN isn't nearly as lucrative as the media deal that the Big Ten pays out to its schools, and as the promise of what the Pac-10 could potentially pay a bigger conference of schools there. So everybody really is taking a look at this with dollar signs in their eyes.
So the president of the University of Nebraska is saying, I get $10 million if I stay, $15 million if I go. Sounds like a no-brainer.
Exactly. Colleges are cutting back and they're cutting back and they're cutting back these days. Where else are they getting this money? Where what ESPN just paid for the ACC, what Fox and ESPN are paying for the Big Ten, really the media rights in college sports are just about the only places where universities are really making money these days.
Talk to me about some of the other schools involved here. The University of Texas has been widely mentioned as a key prize in this whole thing. Why is that?
It basically owns the state of Texas. So if Texas goes to the Pac-10, let's say, and the Pac-10 wants to start a cable channel, its cable channel will be carried throughout the entire state of Texas because you really can't not have Texas games in Texas. You'll go out of business.
I'm going to expose my inner naivete here and mention that this doesn't really speak well for the spirit of college athletics, does it? Oh, well, you laughed at me.
If the spirit of college athletics is about making a lot of money, I think it speaks directly to it. In some aspects, it does, though. They're creating these big power conferences, which are going to create a lot of really good rivalries and have a lot of really good games. I think what a lot of people aren't looking at, let's say, as has been rumored, Texas Tech goes to the Pac-10. Well, the Texas Tech football team will play all the Pac-10 schools, and the Texas Tech basketball team will play all the Pac-10 schools. But what about the Texas Tech softball team? Do they really have the money or the wherewithal to go up to Pullman, Washington, to play Washington State? So people aren't really looking at the non-revenue sports as much as just all this money coming from the football and basketball programs.
Those who are revenue-minded will say that some of this athletic money does go to academic programs.
It's not like this is just a money grab and it's these big, greedy fat cats that are hoarding the money. It does go back into the schools.
Speaking of paying people, what does this do to the on-again, off-again discussion of actually just paying college athletes?
It makes it a more difficult argument to say that these athletes have to essentially play for free when we're talking about these tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars that are going to the conferences and that are going to the universities. I'm not sure if there's really going to be any movement on that. I'm not seeing a ton of movement on that, but it will lead to people that want to see the college athletes paid. It'll give them a bigger platform.
John Orand from the Sports Business Journal. John, thanks so much.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Kai.
We're right at the tail end of graduation season. Not too many more schools and commencement addresses to go. Tomorrow, it's UCLA's turn. 2 years ago, Bill Clinton withdrew as UCLA's speaker at the request of a labor union that was in a dispute with the university. Commentator and journalist Gustavo Arellano is tomorrow's speaker at UCLA, despite a similar request to stay away.
The group that wants me to ditch the pomp and circumstance is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 3299, or AFSCME for short. The union represents UCLA's dorm cleaners, cafeteria workers, and custodians. Recently, the university reduced hours and imposed furloughs on these workers and even laid some off. School administrators claim the cuts are necessary, temporary reactions to massive budget deficits. But try explaining such logic to the workers, where $100 docked off one paycheck is the difference between a stocked refrigerator and a hungry family. AFSCME has asked all commencement speakers at UC schools to boycott the graduations in a show of solidarity. Some speakers have honored the call. I won't. Don't get me wrong. I stand with the workers, and that's why I must speak. I know how unions help families. My tomato canning mom was a Teamster for nearly 20 years. Her membership helped us immensely. Full health benefits, vacation time for mommy, guaranteed work. My dad, on the other hand, was an independent truck driver, but that didn't stop him from joining union efforts over the years to organize troqueros who service the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles. He participated in wildcat strikes, actions where truckers drove their big rigs in a line slowly down the freeway. Dad risked his own job, all for the dream of getting a fair shake for him and his trucking amigos. It's my respect for labor unions that makes me want to cross AFSCME's line. I met with the UCLA workers a couple of weeks ago during their breaks, and almost all reminded me of my parents. Working class, immigrant, toiling for a future for their children. How can I not want to tell their story before an audience of thousands? And yes, I will be reminding the class of 2010 about the troubles these workers face. I hope my union brothers and sisters respect my decision. And if not, I'm prepared for the consequences. For me, publicizing AFSCME's struggle is more important than being deemed anti-union for life.
Gustavo Arellano is a staff writer for the OC Weekly. He also writes the syndicated column, Ask a Mexican. You can write to us through our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, the long-term effects of being long-term unemployed.
Even though I intellectually know it's not my fault, I still kind of blame myself.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 273 points today. That is 2.75%, ended at 10,172. The NASDAQ bounced up 59 points, also 2.75%, 22.18 at the bell. The S&P 500 put on 31 points, nearly 3%, finished at 1,086. Caterpillar continued its winning streak and crawled up another 5.5%. Chevron pumped up 4.75%. American Express deposited 5% today. Del Monte Foods heaped on 6.75% after reporting strong profits. Goldman Sachs fell 2.2% today. The Securities and Exchange Commission is reportedly investigating another of the company's mortgage-linked deals. Uh-oh. The 10-year T-note fell, pushed the yield to 3.32%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm offering practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at nixonpeabody.com. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for May. American Idol has been making and breaking careers for 8 years. It premiered on June 11, 2002. And sports fans gather at Johannesburg for the kickoff of the 2010 FIFA World Cup. Can't make it? ESPN is broadcasting so you can scream for your team from the comfort of your home. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. 6 years and $4 billion after it won the right to host this year's World Cup, the first match kicks off tomorrow in South Africa. Soccer fans everywhere are going to be watching. Locals will be holding their breath, hoping that all the investment in new airports and stadiums is going to pay off. Tens of thousands of tourists will show up and shell out for foods and hotels and souvenirs. But Christopher Wirth reports not all the expectations for the World Cup's big payoff are going to be met.
Marcel Impiani is proud of his new guest house. Although it's located in a rather run-down neighborhood, it's directly across the street from Johannesburg's Ellis Park Stadium, where many of the matches will be played.
We've got six rooms and the lounge there, the TV, and the kitchen. Each and every room we've got toilet.
Opening a guest house here was a bit of a gamble. When they bought the place last year, it was just an abandoned building in an impoverished part of the city. But with the World Cup taking place right at their doorstep, Impiani decided to invest about $40,000 into gutting the building and putting in new walls and floors in time to greet tourists. On our tour, Impiani shows me the dining area.
So what's on the menu?
It depends which guests are we going to get. If they are maybe from Germany, or we've got the menu for. If they are from United States of America, we know the menu for. If they are African, we are ready to give all the food.
The only thing missing now is the guests. Impiani doesn't have a single booking for the month-long event. The global recession could have something to do with that. The projected number of people attending the World Cup has been reduced by about 25% because of the economic slowdown. But Lael Bethlehem says there's another reason the lodge is empty.
People have a somewhat unrealistic view of what the World Cup will bring.
Bethlehem is with the Johannesburg Development Agency, which is in charge of rejuvenating neighborhoods like this. She says over the past couple of years, she's seen guest houses like Impiani's pop up all over the inner city, with many hoping to cater to wealthy foreigners during the World Cup.
So a person might establish a guest house, imagining that a lot of, you know, I don't know, Japanese and German and Brazilian tourists are going to go and stay there, and that that will be enormously profitable. Actually, the World Cup is 4 weeks. So if they've built the business model around the World Cup, it will fail.
For small-time entrepreneurs across the city, the World Cup isn't turning out to be the opportunity they thought it would be. A few miles away in Alexandra Township, street traders have their wares laid out on blankets on the street, selling everything from popcorn to souvenir flags for the World Cup. Tabu Mopasi is a member of the local Chamber of Commerce. He says peddlers like these hope to cater to World Cup visitors, but the game's organizer, FIFA, has barred street traders from selling in areas around the stadiums in favor of its official sponsors.
I think it's going to be a serious nightmare. The people, I think they will be saying the event never benefited them.
Mopasi says political leaders should have been much more clear about just who would benefit from the World Cup and who would be left on the sidelines. In Johannesburg, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Today we're going to start an occasional series that we're going to call Help Not Wanted, about how being out of work for a long time affects people, both in their individual lives and in their communities. We talked about the labor market a little bit earlier today. More people are leaving their jobs to get better ones, but it's always easier to get a job when you have a job. Once you're out of work in this recession, you're almost out of luck. Long-term unemployment hasn't been this bad in this country since the 1940s. Job applicants have to look longer and beat out more competition. Employers, meanwhile, have found ways to get things done without having to hire anybody new. From Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
A lot of people deal with long-term unemployment in isolation, glued to their computers, frantically applying for jobs, keeping their career and financial troubles to themselves. Not Elena Fugman and her friends.
We all take turns. Somebody makes a main dish, and a bunch of us bring side dishes.
Fugman and her husband rent this small bungalow in Portland with another couple. Today, she's invited over members of her self-help group for the unemployed. They're planning their monthly potluck.
It's been some of the best spread a lot of us have seen in a while. We put a lot of work into it.
Sitting around the dining room table, they tell me they've all been looking for paid work for a year or more. George Slanina is 59. He had a green job before green was cool. Unfortunately, a lot of other people got the same idea. He was laid off from doing environmental site work when the housing market collapsed. Now he can't get his resume in the door.
The schools have been cranking out a lot of environmental scientists. I've applied with the city of Portland and I was put on a list with 60 other qualified people for one position.
Slanina's wife still has her job, so he says they'll be okay, at least until summer when his unemployment runs out. Lise Brown is 48 and worked several corporate jobs, then took time off to stay home with her daughter. She's been trying to get back in for 2.5 years. Her timing couldn't be worse.
I apply for, on average, about 5 jobs a week. They're very low-paying jobs, $10 an hour, and I used to make $50,000 a year. I do own a home since I did have a middle-class job before, so I've been refinancing my home, maxing out credit cards, and borrowing money from relatives.
Brown's husband lost his job as a manager, then landed another job as a cook, so their income's down drastically. Fugman calls in from the kitchen that the potluck's a draw for others in the same boat.
Some of my friends did start coming because, you know, it is having a free meal is a big deal.
Well, just some people are just ashamed. They're ashamed that their house is in foreclosure. They don't want to talk about it. And then I've noticed that some people are actually realizing, gee, I'm still unemployed. I think I might come to that potluck.
The only one here doing okay is Ted Pyle. He's 64. He's been a mechanic, a carpenter, a painter, often paid under the table.
All these skills have been marginalized down to being kind of useless, but I have so many of them that somebody has a broken down car, somebody has a clogged sink, so I'm always picking up 10 or 20 here and there. But people who don't have my diversity are pretty screwed.
Middle-class professionals have been hit hard in this recession compared to past downturns. People with advanced technical training or university degrees usually find new jobs relatively quickly when they're laid off, but not this time around.
Every measure we're seeing now related to how long people are getting stuck in unemployment is shattering all records since the Great Depression.
That's Heidi Shierholz at the Economic Policy Institute. She points out that nearly half of unemployed people have been hunting for more than 6 months. That's a 60-year high. For every job that opens up, five people are trying to get it. Before the recession, the ratio was less than 2 to 1. And even if employers started adding a few hundred thousand jobs every month, and they're nowhere near that right now, it would take several years just to catch up to the number of jobs we had when the recession started.
Even though I intellectually know it's not my fault, I still kind of blame myself.
George Slanina is the 59-year-old environmental scientist.
In the 2 years I've been unemployed, I still don't sleep right. I always wake up with anxiety and stuff. What's going to happen?
It's a question a lot of people Slanina's age are asking. They face a midlife job crisis, competing against younger, cheaper candidates with new degrees. They may never find decent full-time work again. In her 30s, Elena Fugman's got most of her career ahead of her. She got off to a good start with her Ivy League degree and several nonprofit jobs, but now she's surviving on unemployment and government-subsidized health insurance. She could end up part of a huge lost generation that doesn't catch up financially or professionally for decades to come.
I never really saw myself as someone who would rely on government services, and that I am so fully is a little humbling and humiliating. We're actually having to borrow from our parents right now because they're doing better than we are.
And economist Heidi Shierholz says life's about to get even tougher for the long-term unemployed because the economy's starting to rebound. Yep, economy recovers, job search gets harder.
Those workers who dropped out of or never entered the labor force during the downturn are starting to come back.
2.5 million of them.
And when they start coming back, that's really going to keep that unemployment rate, these job seekers per job openings rate, very elevated. So the long-term unemployed aren't going to catch a break for quite a while.
At least in Portland, they can catch a free meal.
I'm thinking about a big lasagna. It feeds a lot of people, not too expensive.
The Unemployed People's Potluck gets served up today. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a commentary on how corporate America really feels about the economy. You know how when people are a little nervous about things, they tend to keep a little extra cash on hand just in case things get tight? Companies are doing the same thing. The Federal Reserve reported today that U.S. businesses have more cash and liquid assets on hand than they've had in almost 60 years. This all goes to the general vibe that's out there, that businesses think the economy is better but not yet good. They're still nervous to hire and make big investments and would rather just hold on to their cash. Of course, on the other hand, the Fed also said today that the rising stock market has increased personal wealth the past 3 months. So I guess it's all in how you look at it. However you look at it, that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow rose 273 points, 2.75%. The NASDAQ up 59 points, also 2.75%. The S&P 500 packed on 31 points, nearly 3% there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, real estate is a long and winding road.
Back at the bottom of it, but I feel more comfortable being at the bottom of the stepping stone than where we were.
When renting is better than buying, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.